sorry, Mel. Think about me when you're living your life, one day after another, all in a neat pattern. Think about the homeless traveller and his old police box, his days like crazy paving.
He was the last of the classic doctors.
Unless you count Paul McGann.
Or Rowan Atkinson.
Or Richard E. Grant.
From Time and the Ronnie to Survival.
And beyond through the wilderness years.
Sylvester McCoy defined the doctor for years.
Kathleen Showalter joins us to talk about Lucky Number 7.
On the March 13th edition of This Week in Time Travel.
Well, hello, Chip. It's good to be seeing you again.
Hey, Alyssa. It is time for our Seventh Doctor retrospective, where we'll be joined by Kathleen Showalter after the news. Lots to talk about this week, including an update on Who Against Guns, some unexpected VAM, possibly a recurring master, and a surprise cast announcement that came just a little early.
We're going to throw it ahead to Future Chip to give us an update on Who Against Guns.
So this segment has been recorded as close to the release of this episode of This Week in Time Travel as we could possibly manage. Hi, I'm Future Chip, and with me is Future Rachel. Hey, Rachel.
Hey.
It's been a few weeks since you've been on Twit as part of our Twit cabal, because you've been involved in a lot of stuff, including you've been part of the shadowy cabal that's been behind hashtag Who Against Guns. We have reached just a big milestone in the campaign.
We have. So as of today, when we're recording this, which is Monday, March 12th, which is when we released the podcasts out into the wild. Hooray. We have raised well over $15,000 over a couple of weeks, and that was from 570 unique donors.
Wow. Who Against Guns was and is a campaign to raise money for four really important charities in the U.S. And all it took was for people to send us copies of their receipts of their direct donations to those organizations. We, those of us involved in Who Against Guns, never handled any money ourselves, but $15,000 from donors across the globe. We got retweeted by a Brooklyn Nine-Nine cast member. We had special podcast commentaries from Stephen Moffat and Philip Hinchcliffe. This has been amazing.
It's been incredible. And I am so overwhelmed by the number of people who donated, and especially because it's a cause that is so meaningful and so present right now. And knowing that we've made a significant impact on all of these organizations, on March for Our Lives, the Brady Campaign, Moms Demand Action, and Community Justice Reform Coalition, you know, these are meaningful chunks of money. And I'm just so, so grateful to everybody who donated.
Tell me a little bit more about those donors.
Yeah. So like I said, we had about 570 unique donors, and two-thirds of them donated $20 or less. And it just goes to show you that even if you think your donation is small, $10 here, $20 or here, if you add it all up together in our big Whovian family, you know, we've done a lot of good in the world, and we should all be proud of ourselves and look forward to seeing what these organizations do moving forward.
It was loads of fun recording commentaries with podcasters and Doctor Who fans and Doctor Who creators all over the place for this thing. So where will contributors find their commentaries?
So most people should have received an email by now if you donated prior to the noon Monday, March 12th deadline. If you do not, let us know. You can reply to gallifreystands@realitybombpodcast.com. You can also continue to send donations to that email address. Send us a copy of your receipt, and we'll send you a download link for the podcast with instructions. And there's your 13 episodes there of the 10 episodes of The War Games, and all of them are going to be different but fun and an interesting twist on watching a good classic Who story.
I think one of my favorite bits of the campaign was seeing the milestones being celebrated by Dr. Puppet.
Oh, yes. They were so brilliant. Some still images and GIFs, and thank you to her so much.
The campaign push is over at the time this podcast is released, but that's just the campaign push.
Oh, absolutely. We'll be accepting those receipts through March 31st, and the link will be live to download the podcast through April 1st. And one other thing, if you've seen some of the campaign graphics we've had with the Who Against Guns hashtag and quotes from Doctor Who that are available on the Reality Bomb podcast website, if you print those out and make signs and go to one of the marches on March 24th that March for Our Lives is putting on, take a picture of yourselves and hashtag it for us. We want to see some of the Doctor Who community in action.
Reality Bomb's Graham Burke and Joy Piedmont and you were really, really doing a lot of heavy lifting behind the scenes for Who Against Guns. It was a big group effort, but I want to specifically highlight what you and Graham and Joy did for this, Rachel. We're so proud that you're a part of the TWiT family and so proud of the work that you did to support Who Against Guns. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thanks to everybody else. We had a huge team of people behind all of this. I had an amazing donations team. Jen Clapp, Jen Burt, Will York, Shannon Dohar, Adrian Enderley, and Kathleen Showalter. They were just rock stars logging all the donations. So I appreciate every single one of them.
Thanks for talking with me about this, Future Rachel.
Thanks, Future Chip.
And Classic Doctor Who is back on plastic disc, the season 12 Blu-ray with extra VAM and restoration is coming out. It's all of the collected stories from season 12. They have supposedly been upgraded again to a newer, shinier version of the visuals, so that should be fun to watch. For those of you who are not familiar with what VAM means, it's value-added material, so it's all of the extra interviews and special documentaries and behind the scenes looks into the creations of all of the stories. This is the start of BBC releasing Doctor Who stories, not as individual episodes, DVDs, but like full seasons together, the way that we do modern box sets. So me looking up at all of my random collected stories is feeling a little bit like I just invested in all of these individual DVDs and now you do the series altogether collected, but this should be exciting.
It should be, and it should look really great. The restoration team has been working on these for months now, trying to do what they can to make this look as great as possible on 1080p high definition video. They're not able to go back and take the film segments and do a spearhead from space on them. It is going to look nicer, and I had given up on DVD and value-added material and all the great packaging, you know, they'd seem to just sort of drop off. And I had assumed that that was because they were moving to iTunes and streaming and all this other stuff. It's apparently instead that they were moving into an even better long-term format for collectors, and I'm super happy about that. The value-added material will include a new interview with Tom Baker and just loads and loads of stuff. I don't think season 12 of Doctor Who, Tom Baker's first season, could possibly look any better until they create holographic doubles of everything.
So, you know, 20 years' time, we'll all be replacing these anyway. We also got a hint in Doctor Who magazine that Michelle Gomez may be back for Doctor Who.
I imagine that she'd require an invitation from Chris Chibnall or whatever, but yeah.
Michelle Gomez requires an invitation for nothing. She will stroll on set and go, I am now a part of this story.
Well, you know, nobody ever believed that John Sim would come back, and yet he did. And it worked out pretty darn well, even though it was a different showrunner and he pitched the performance entirely differently. Michelle Gomez will be busy with Sabrina, as we mentioned previously in a new segment. who knows when it would happen. But it's nice to see that she is certainly not closing the door on the Master coming back. And I could see her and Jodie Whittaker just really sparking off of each other. Such a contrast.
That would be an excellent mashup. Cross my fingers that that happens sometime in the future. We also had a little bit of casting news that somehow managed to make it past Chris Chibnall's barricade of Doctor Who information. Alan Cumming kind of opened his mouth a little too early.
Yep. He's very, very sorry that he spilled the fact on the Homo Sapiens podcast that he will be playing James I, the King of Scotland who became the first Stuart King of England, in an upcoming episode of Doctor Who. He wasn't supposed to say it. He apologized on Twitter. But yeah, he describes James I as a, quote, nice baddie, close quote. And James I had some issues. He suppressed Puritans. He suppressed Catholics. He was not a big fan of supposed witches. So, you know, a nice baddie. But Alan Cumming is fantastic and phenomenal, and I'd love to see what he'd do with the role.
Absolutely. So it sounds like they might be giving him a role in which he's not explicitly set up as the villain of the story, but perhaps not exactly the nicest guy either. So I'm curious to see how they approach that.
So lots of stuff happened in the last week of time travel. When we come back, we'll talk about the Seventh Doctor and the end of the classic era of Doctor Who.
This week on The Incomparable Network, Quinn Rose and Jen Lucas lovingly dissect the groundbreaking musical about cartoonist Alison Bechdel, Fun Home, on Corner of the Sky.
On Random Trek, Anna Markhart from the blog Fashion It So joins Scott to discuss cute robots and a judgmental Picard in the next-gen episode, Quality of Life.
And why is it so hard to get audiences to come back for a second season of Brilliant TV? Join Tim Goodman and Jason Snell on the TV Talk Machine.
All this and more at TheIncomparable.com. Welcome back to This Week in Time Travel. Last week, we talked about the Sixth Doctor, and our guest Jason Snell from the Incomparable Network averred that possibly it wasn't the Sixth Doctor's fault that Doctor Who was having trouble in the 80s. He seemed to lay the blame, Alyssa, at the feet of the Seventh Doctor, which seemed to be an opinion that some people can have. Surprise the fool out of me, though.
Yes, so we're going to dig into that controversial assertion today.
That's right. But we're going to speak more broadly about the Seventh Doctor as portrayed by Sylvester McCoy. And with us is Kathleen Showalter. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Doing great.
Thank you for letting me come on to defend the Seventh Doctor's honor.
I personally don't think he needs that much defending. He's one of my favorites, actually. But you spent a lot of time at the Gallifrey One convention on Seventh Doctor panels. It was a really Seventh Doctor heavy convention because Sylvester was and Sophie Aldred were actually there. But long, slow pitch over the plate. What do you think of the Seventh Doctor?
I love the Seventh Doctor. I wouldn't say he's my doctor because that's more of an emotional thing. But I think he is such a wonderful, complex, layered version of a doctor. We see so much of the incarnations that come before him and so much of the incarnations that come after him within his character. I think Sylvester McCoy plays him with a range that is extraordinary. And I just think it's like Doctor Who's punk rock era, and it's fantastic and fabulous, and there's so much to talk about.
He didn't initially, in that very first appearance in Time of the Ronnie, I remember sitting in a college dorm room, gathered around a tiny television, watching a bootleg transcoded video, Time in the Ronnie, before it ever appeared on PBS. He seemed like a clown. He seemed funny. He was constantly messing up cliched phrases. You know, every dogma has its day. You know, just sort of, he seemed like a goofball. And yet, by the end, he was something completely different.
Agreed. That first outing, it's both the writers and producers and Sylvester McCoy kind of getting a feeling for the character. I love that beginning, even though it's really the Ronnie's performance in that episode that that keeps me coming back? Because when you start with the time of the Rani and you go all the way through, and it's not a very long, it's not that many episodes, but when I say all the way, but when you go through to Survival, which is his last story, so 3 years really, three seasons, he has a real character arc where, exactly as you said, he changes from what seems to be someone who isn't thinking and is just a clown. But it changes really quickly away from just a clown, even though the character arc is going to take the three whole seasons. But even when we turn around and we go to Paradise Towers in the very next episode, we're already starting to see signs of the Doctor as the master manipulator. And that comes pretty quickly. One of the things that I think makes the Sylvester McCoy portrayal work is that there is always this sense of two things happening at once. There's something on the surface, whether he's playing the spoons or he's taking a header over a platform. And at the same time, his actions and his words and his face, he's really got an extraordinary face, tells you that there's another plan unfolding. There's always another plan unfolding. So with Paradise Towers, he's launching himself not as dramatically into danger as he does when he, in the Happiness Patrol, he brings them to a place to find a problem to solve, which is something the Seventh Doctor does. He's about long-term strategy. He doesn't just happen to find himself most of the time after those first few someplace. I mean, it happens, but he's looking for problems to solve. He's actively, proactively looking for things to make a change out of. Very early on, he isn't really letting his companions know about this. He sort of launches them like weapons. And I do think that's one of the things that changes over time.
There's also during this time period sort of the introduction of the Cartmel master plan, which is never fully realized, but comes through on screen with a few hints that there is something darker and more mysterious to the Doctor's character than we don't already know. Mm-hmm. And that lends itself to really giving more of a master manipulator kind of feel to later Seventh Doctor stories, because they are at that point some competing tensions over how to define the Seventh Doctor and make him more mysterious. You know, Andrew Cartmell was trying to push for some of these things in the scripts, but John Nathan Turner had some of these hints removed from scripts, or there were some scenes that were filmed but not included in the UK broadcast version that were included in the Canadian broadcast version. So there's actually a lot of different sort of competing images of what the Seventh Doctor is like depending on when you were watching and what version of it that you saw. But they really were much more intentionally leaning into a darker, more mysterious version of what the Doctor would be.
Absolutely. And there's a way in which the Cartmell Master Plan is such a great term that we've given it, and we like to associate it entirely with Andrew Cartmell, who only comes on as the script editor, the showrunner, with season 24. But elements that are there are there in the previous season as well. Cartmell has the distinction of being someone who really did want to overthrow the government through Doctor Who. So he's definitely looking at it as a way to say something. He wants to break things. That's one reason that calling it a punk rock moment is that there is something darker, but it's also there's a little bit of anarchy or realization that there's something about the fact that the show was already being watched by fewer people at this moment. They gave them the freedom to try a lot of different things from the time in the Rani, and then very distinctly with bringing in Andrew Cartmell. So the fewer people that are watching, the more you can take chances and make big swings. And the big swings don't always work. There are lots of things about Paradise Towers, which is one of my favorite episodes, that really don't work or are really, really creepy or unpleasant or weird when you first see them. But he's trying to say something pretty profound. Like, everyone is trying to say something pretty profound about the nature of what it means to be a person and an individual throughout a lot of these stories.
And if Andrew Cartmell was interested in being political AF and being subversive as far as the UK government at the time was and things like that, I think he was also being subversive about the show itself, sort of using that as a bit of a strategy, making people question things. You go to Remembrance of the Daleks, which is one of my favorites, and he's doing some retcon work on the first Doctor's origin story. Why was the first Doctor mucking about at Foreman's salvage yard or something? He was actually messing around with the Hand of Omega. That's different.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of playing with the Doctor's origin story during this time period and really trying to sort of rewrite some aspects of the show, which is something that's going to carry through into sort of the New Adventures novels and things like that, that they are really going to go back and dig into sort of what drives the Doctor to want to travel, to want to muddle about in all of these adventures. And it works for some people and it doesn't work for other people. I think that, you know, it's one of those things that there are, you know, sort of the way you talk about how Doctor Who really, you know, has no canon. It has a very convoluted continuity. there's people that you can take what you like from this era and work it into your own sort of interpretation of what you think defines the Doctor Who continuity. But there's a lot of people who just sort of breeze on past it and don't really work it into their whole conception of Doctor Who's continuity, and it can exist. And there's a lot of interesting ideas that are explored and brought up there, but haven't necessarily been, you know, set in stone by later Doctor Who episodes, that there's really a lot of room to do what people want to do with any of this mucking about in the origin story.
There are certain things that stay from the Seventh Doctor's era and are brought into canon, but they're more conceptual than they are the specific details that get mentioned, like the ones you spoke to. I think there's a way in which you can't have the Gallifrey and the Time Lords of the new series, and you can't have the Doctors of the new series if you don't have the Seventh Doctor.
Interesting.
Because I mean, there are many reasons that I'm going to say that, but one is just reaching back to what you've been saying, Alyssa, is this mysterious element of the Time Lords, of these being beings of power and political intrigue, and the Doctor having conflict with them. I mean, we get that in the Fourth Doctor. It's not like these things haven't happened with other Doctors, but the mythos, I think, you get much more of the mythos growing up in the Seventh Doctor. And the people who wrote during the Wilderness years, that wrote the ongoing adventures of the Seventh Doctor, those are the people who then wrote the scripts for the Ninth Doctor and the Tenth Doctor and became the showrunners. So there's a way in which the viewer can maybe skip over some of these things about the Seventh Doctor. But then if they go and they're watching the Ninth Doctor or the Tenth Doctor, those portrayals of the Ninth or the Tenth Doctor, of that Gallifrey, of that Time War, they don't exist without the Seventh Doctor from the creator side or the world-building side, even if the viewer isn't immediately aware of them.
One of the interesting things that's very fascinating about the Seventh Doctor era is that a lot of what was done sort of after the show was canceled really becomes the basis for the rebooted show. So even though some of the nitpickier continuity details don't really come through, like,
looms.
You know, you've got looms.
I love looms.
I'm not as much of a fan. I'm very much not a fan of the looms, but like there's the continuity details like looms that don't get brought in. But you do have a lot of stories that are written for the Seventh Doctor that get brought in later. The biggest example, I think, that comes to mind for me personally is Human Nature by Paul Cornell. The story was originally written for the Seventh Doctor, and then it gets brought in through later with the Tenth Doctor. And so many people have said over and over again how really Ace is sort of the foundational model for what you're going to have later with Rose as a companion.
Absolutely. And there's a way in which Human Nature works for the Tenth Doctor and it works for the Seventh Doctor, because these are doctors who had a warmth and an affection and a strong bond with their companions. They were a little less likely to abandon them on the side of a road. The companion in the Seventh Doctor stories, the ones that are televised, as well as the ones that become books like Human Nature, becomes much more front and center. There are so many stories here that are about Ace, where Ace is someone with agency. Ace is someone who changes. And they're not Dr. Light episodes full on, but where her storyline is the A plot, right? And that is something that we definitely see in 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th Doctor stories. Human nature needs us to believe that there's something humane, that there's something recognizably emotional, like a recognizable emotional connection between the Doctor and the people around him and between this world. You need to have that connection to make Love and War work, or else it doesn't have that emotional punch to it.
So speaking of Ace, Sylvester McCoy inherited Bonnie Langford as Mel for his first few episodes, but almost universally, people think of the Seventh Doctor and Ace as just when that companion partnership really, really clicks and when the Seventh Doctor comes into his own. How important was it to bring Sophie Aldred in and to give the Seventh Doctor that kind of companion?
I think the things about Ace, aside from just like the joy of her character and of her portrayal, is that we needed to have a companion. And there's a way in which Sarah Jane, for example, I think you could pop her down in here, but a companion who is bursting with their own agency, with their own curiosity, with their own reason for running away and for wanting to do good and to make change in the world. You needed to have a companion who had was given a three-dimensional character, or where a three-dimensional character could be built onto an original kind of two-dimensional interpretation and see where that went in order to make the story changes, in order to have the relationship, in order to have these arcs, the greater importance of the companion within the whole story. I don't think it could only be Ace or only be Sophie Aldred, but Sophie Aldred also in her acting style has a very naturalistic and kind of a quiet style of acting, for all that she's waving a baseball bat and explosives in character sometimes, where a lot of the acting we see happens in her face and is very quiet. And it's a lot of its reaction to things that the Doctor does or that other people do. And it reminds me a little bit, actually, of the Fifth Doctor. But it also reminds me a little bit of modern acting performances more than... And this is not to say anything at all negative about Mel, but it stands in pretty distinct contrast, Ace and Mel, right? Those two different kinds of acting styles.
I do feel very bad for Bonnie Langford, though, because it's, you know, her character wasn't really set up in the best possible way to succeed.
No.
She has a very confused introduction, and it is hard to see a, you know, good relationship get established between her and the Seventh Doctor, just because there isn't really good grounds for her character. We don't really know a ton about Mel. She's one of those characters in which a lot of traits and characteristics sort of get assigned to her sans context. So it's kind of a little strange. And then she also, to top everything off, also has sort of one of the weirdest departures. It's just, I'm going to go and travel with this pirate now. Okay, bye. And it's just a very, you know, when you see Ace come in, you see her join the Doctor, you see their adventures, you see that final striding off into the sunset together. You really get a sense that they are two people who have been building a relationship. You see Ace grow over time. You learn more details of her story and who she is and how she sees her place in the universe, how she sees her place traveling with the Doctor. So she feels like more of a full and complete character at times than poor Mel does. And Mel has good moments, you know? I don't want to be hating on Bonnie Langford. It's just, I feel so bad for her because she wasn't really set up to really have a really interesting character, successful tenure, it seems.
No, and her character, like you're saying, her character is not very round. Like, we're told that she's really good at, I think it's really good at...
computer programming.
There we go. So that she's really good at that, but we're told it. We're not really shown it. And she had decided to leave the show, and so they were writing characters to see who was going to stick as a companion through all of that initial series. And they didn't really know when she was going to go, and it ends up with that being a little weird in terms of the dynamic And I think that both Sylvester McCoy and Bonnie Langford do what they can to give you that warmth in that relationship, that sort of attempt to be the way that she's a caretaker and he's a caretaker. They're both trying to take care of each other. But when I try and think back about Mel, a lot of times what I remember is the screaming, partly because I think she broke an eardrum in Paradise Towers a few times there.
But I don't believe it.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. There's something, though, kind of lovely about the way that she gets to leave by her own agency, even though what she chooses to do is a little wacky. She at least says, I don't want to travel with you anymore. She's not killed. She's not just abandoned. She's not kicked out. She gets to choose. But I think you're very right about Ace having a sense of the world and for us to have a sense of her experience. There's an interiority to the Ace character, a perspective on what it's like to travel with the Doctor that's internal to the companion that we don't have with a lot, if not most, of the previous companions. Like, we have no idea why Tegan whines a lot about wanting to go home, and she kind of fell into it by accident. But we don't have as much information about their life outside the TARDIS, the impact that it has on it, or their reactions to things. And I think you need to have that to make an arc like Ace's work. And I think you need to have that to tell the kind of stories that the new series wants to tell.
Absolutely. So in our last few minutes here, I wanted to talk about Sylvester McCoy's appearance in the TV movie, handing the baton over to Paul McGann. He's in for like a quarter to a third of the movie before Paul McGann shows up. And what does he have to do but drink some tea and get shot?
The Seventh Doctor is a character. He's a master manipulator. He's a character of strategy, not just tactics. Like many, many other doctors, and almost all of them, tend to be people who are good in a crisis. They're reacting to the situation in front of them. Here's another plan. Here's another plan. He actually is planning ahead of time. And he thinks he knows that he's right, and he thinks he's got a handle on that. And that goes off the rails a little bit sometimes, and he's disgusted with himself. What's funny about the TV movie is it's almost as though he laid down that strategy and that master manipulator and let down his guard. I find the TARDIS really great in the movie. I enjoy watching Sylvester McCoy powder with a cup of tea. I mean, I really would have watched that for 2 solid hours. But it's not the same character. He's not actively launching people like missiles, like he launches Ace into situations to see what will explode. He's on his own. He doesn't have a companion. And he doesn't have a plan. And then he just seems sort of baffled by the things that happen. He thinks about how people tick and how things work. And if I do this, and they'll do that. He's a chess player. So the fact that he wouldn't think that the Master, who, it's not like this is the first time the Master's done something like this, that it wouldn't occur to him that there could be a problem with this plan is just, it just doesn't ring true to me. And I find kind of upsetting.
So we'll say that the TV movie is not going to be your recommendation for the best introduction to the Seventh Doctor.
No.
Alyssa and Kathleen, what are your exemplar Seventh Doctor stories?
I think my personal favorite Seventh Doctor story would have to be Battlefield. I think it is a delightful story overall. I think it is fun and exciting and funny and brings in some old favorite characters, particularly the Brigadier. And then you have Brigadier Bambara as well, who is just such a wonderful character that I love her to pieces. Most of season 26, Curse of Fenric is also amazing.
Yeah.
And Survival is also good. Paradoxically, I think I would recommend most of season 26 for newcomers to the Seventh Doctor to begin with, even though it is his final season and the final season for the classic series, that it's really just some of the top Seventh Doctor stories that show him off in his best form, and I think ones that are most accessible for beginners, except perhaps Ghostlight. Ghostlight is kind of the weird one in season 26.
I think that in some ways, I'd absolutely agree with that recommendation. The Curse of Fenric is a story that you can show to someone who's never seen Doctor Who. You can show it to them cold, and it works almost like a movie. everything you need to know is there and it's shown to you. And it has the excitement, it has the science fiction, it has the fantasy, it has also the manipulation and this great intercessory figure of Ace that you can really engage with that story, even if you don't know who the people are. So I think Curse of Fenric, I would agree. I mean, my favorite story is probably Happiness Patrol. It's probably one of my top three Doctor Who stories of all time because there's so much going on there. But both Happiness Patrol and Paradise Towers, which is another favorite, and Delta and the Bannermen require that you're introducing the Doctor to somebody who likes satire, who gets satire and sarcasm very quickly, and that wants to be watching the show for more than just the science fiction, for more than just the explosion, and who is going to take delight in weird costumes and strange things happening and not just immediately write it off. For the average viewer, I would go Fenric, but somebody who liked something like prestige television, I would be really tempted to give them the Happiness Patrol and see what they made of it, because it's such an amazing political critique of Margaret Thatcher and of what's happening. The use of race, of class, of gender, of sexuality is so complicated. It's going to appeal to people who like their stories really dense and really complicated and to be operating on a level that is plot, but is also stage and acting and color and sound and interaction with the wider cultural forces. So, and I actually think the Candyman plays into that before somebody says anything about the Candyman. The Candyman works because he is a walking, talking critique of capitalism. Happiness Patrol, two thumbs up.
We made it through. We did get a reference to Ghost Light, which is a story that causes me a small amount of pain, because that was the when I was getting back into Doctor Who after the new series began, and I begged for advice. Okay, recommend the best classic series story that I can get back into the classic series with. And Chris Burgess from Radio Free Skaro immediately says, without hesitation, Ghost Light. And I've never quite forgiven him.
We do need to wrap up now. So, Kathleen, thank you so much for coming on to chat about the Seventh Doctor with us.
Thank you for having me. It's always a delight to talk about the Seventh Doctors, and always a delight to talk to you guys.
Thanks, Kathleen. Thank you for listening to This Week in Time Travel. This week, we'll be back with Paul McGann. Well, not Paul McGann, but we'll be back with the Eighth Doctor. Well, we'll be back talking about the Eighth Doctor. This is hard. I'm sorry. You can find This Week in Time Travel on the web at thisweekintimetravel.com or at theincomparable.com. We tweet at DR Who this week, I tweet at numeral 2 minute time lord, and Alyssa tweets and tumbles at Whovian Feminism. Kathleen tweets at K Showalter, that's K-S-C-H-O-W-A-L-T-E-R. We're also on Facebook.
This Week in Time Travel is hosted by Jason Snell's The Incomparable Network. You can support our show by becoming a member and ticking the box for This Week in Time Travel and any other incomparable shows you like at theincomparable.com/members. We have to also thank Christopher Breen for our original theme music and David J. Lohr for our original podcast logo and avatar. For Tuesday, March 13th, it's been This Week in Time Travel, and we will see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Donors, and of those donations, two-thirds of them were $20 or less.
Could you repeat that, because Charlotte?